Welcome to our discussion of Rabban Gamliel, the tyrant, meaning that there are a number of sources that seem to indicate that Rabban Gamliel, who clearly was one of the great sages, we talk about him in the Haggadah, he's very prominent in many Mishnayos, and he was the Nasi, he was the prince, the leader of the Jewish community, to what extent, after the destruction of the temple, to what extent that was a formal title, or whether it was just an internal title, or whether that was an official Roman position that he had, not that significant, but for us, he was in charge. It seems that he ran a very, very tight ship, almost a tyrannical ship. And the question is that the only image we have of Gamliel? What else do we know about him? Is it a little more textured than just being a tyrannical figure who shapes things up after the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed? Obviously, temple is destroyed. We talked about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai last time. He was there at the front line the very first few years the temple was destroyed. He makes various institutions that assure that certain memories of the temple, the Beis HaMikdash, will be preserved. And then and then he somehow disappears. We don't know exactly why he disappeared. Clearly, Rabban Gamliel would be a better choice because he has royal blood. They have a tradition that he comes from David, comes from Hillel more recently, and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai does not. We mentioned Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai may have been a Kohen. We have evidence that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai migrated to different places, and Rabban Gamliel takes over perhaps as a very young man. Should note that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai saved Rabban Gamliel. He asked the Romans to preserve him, implying perhaps that Rabban Gamliel and his family, because they were of royal lineage, that they were perhaps pro-revolution when they were revolting in Jerusalem. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai gave up on the revolution. He sort of threw up the white flag. Rabban Gamliel may represent the family that kind of was a little more in favor of the revolution in Jerusalem. Anyway, having said that, let's begin with this story. So we have here tonight Ben and Shirley, and if we could just take turns, just for the purposes of YU Torah, which is recording our talk, if you would just want to read that first source for us. If you want, it's a long source. If you want, you can pass the mic at a certain point. It's a two-page source. This is the Gemara in Brachos, 27b to 28a. Bakasha.
Consider the story of a student who came to Rabbi... Sure.
Could you hold it closer? Yeah. Thanks.
Consider the story of a student who came to Rabbi Yehoshua and asked him, evening prayer, is it voluntary or obligatory?
We're talking about the Shemona Esrei of Maariv, what we call Maariv. We're not talking about the Shema. Everybody knows you have to say Shema twice a day. But we're talking about the evening prayer. Is it obligatory or is it voluntary? Go ahead.
He said, voluntary. The student went before Rabban Gamliel and asked him, evening prayer, is it voluntary or obligatory? He said, obligatory. The student said to him, but Rabbi Yehoshua taught me it is voluntary. Rabban Gamliel said, wait until the shield bearers, that is, the sages who are compared to warriors, enter the house of study and then ask your question. When the shield bearers entered, the student arose and asked, evening prayer, is it voluntary or obligatory? Rabban Gamliel said, obligatory. Rabban Gamliel said to the sages, is there anyone who disagrees on this matter? Rabbi Yehoshua said, no.
Okay, that's a joke, right? The only one person who disagreed in the room said, no, I don't disagree. But everyone knew he was on to him. Clearly, he disagreed. Go ahead.
Rabban Gamliel said, but it was in your name that it was said to be voluntary. He said, Yehoshua, stand up on your feet and be examined on this matter.
Sort of the dunce cap type of thing. Go ahead.
Rabbi Yehoshua stood up on his feet and said, if I was alive and he was dead, the living could deny the dead. But now that I am alive and he is alive, how can the living deny the living?
What the cryptic meaning of this is a matter of discussion, but the simple meaning is that it's almost like he alludes to the idea, you know, I wish you weren't even here, but since you're here, I can't really deny it because we're both living and I can't wiggle out of this one, but definitely tongue in cheek. Okay.
Rabban Gamliel was sitting and teaching while Rabbi Yehoshua was standing.
So let's take a break for a second as we leave Rabbi Yehoshua standing in the dunce corner. This idea that Maariv is obligatory or voluntary, it's not absolutely clear what that means. They may be arguing in a very stark contrast that Rabban Gamliel feels you must daven Maariv every night. This morning, Esrei, and Rabbi Yeshua says you can or don't have to. It's totally up to you. There are various other options, such as that it's relatively not obligatory, meaning there is such a thing as Maariv, but if you have other mitzvahs to do, taking care of your parents or learning Torah or anything else, that would trump this mitzvah. So it may be a question of relative obligation, but. Let's assume for these purposes, for historical purposes, it's kind of interesting to ponder the idea that he was really just saying, well, you can if you want to, you don't have to if you don't want to. Go ahead.
Rabbi Yehoshua was left standing until all shouted for Utzpit, the crier, to stop calling out Rabban Gamliel's words, and he stopped.
Okay, now, there, in those days, there would be large gatherings. They had no microphones. It wasn't proper to expect the rabbi to shout out the whole lecture. So the rabbi would sort of mutter the lecture to the people closest to him, and then the meturgeman, who was basically a town caller, he would then call out the class to everyone else. They told the town crier to stop saying over the lecture.
They said, "How long will Rabban Gamliel continue to humiliate him? He tormented him last year during the Hebrew New Year when he forced Rabbi Yehoshua to travel to him on the date that was the Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, according to Yehoshua's, but not Rabban Gamliel's, reckoning."
Right, so we'll get into the exact story there a little bit later. Go ahead.
"He tormented him in the case of Rabbi Zadok and the firstborn, when he also forced him to stand as a public humiliation."
A similar story is told there. Go ahead.
"Here again, he torments him."
So it's the third time that he's really treating him very poorly. Go ahead.
"Let us replace Rabban Gamliel as the head of the house of study."
Okay. Now, this, so apparently everyone held Rabbi Yehoshua in very high esteem. For example, Rabbi Yehoshua is the teacher of Rabbi Akiva. Also Rabbi Eliezer. So Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua, they're the teachers of Rabbi Akiva. Many Mishnayos are debates between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua. They are just, and many Midrashim, they are the basic staples of all Midrashim. They are students of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He is not. We don't know who Rabbi Gamliel's actual teachers are. Clearly Rabbi Gamliel was a competent scholar. In those days, competent scholar meant he knew all the Mishnayos. He was a Tana. He instituted certain new things. But there is a sense that we're not talking about the same league. That although he's the head of the yeshiva and people accept that idea, well, he's from a famous lineage and he was saved from the destruction of the temple and someone has to be in charge and it might as well be him. They accept that to some degree, but when they see him disparaging Rabbi Yehoshua, who's clearly a greater scholar, that's a problem. So there's often a distinction between the official heads of various things and the actual great scholars. So they actually decided to try to remove him. We're not going to get into exactly what happened as far as that goes, but there are two versions as to what is going to happen. We'll talk about that later. What will happen instead of having Rabban Gamliel at the head? Let's continue.
One second, please.
Yes.
As this story is related, the narration is not clear, and it doesn't seem that meaningful, perhaps, up until now, but it gets to the point where it says, "Let us replace." Suddenly, it becomes important. Who is saying, "Let us
replace"? Oh, the crowd, the students. But we see Rabbi Akiva has a key role there. They're clearly taking up for Rabbi Yehoshua, but they can't replace him with Rabbi Yehoshua, they say, and I skip this part because he's part of the debate and the controversy. They can't replace him with Rabbi Akiva because, as opposed to Rabbi Gamliel, who has Davidic lineage, Rabbi Akiva has convert lineage, which is a negative. Somebody curses him or something like that, he'll have no has no merit of his forefathers to stand in the stead. So they decided to pick this young whippersnapper who was sort of neither here nor there. He was only 17 years old. He was a great scholar. He was descended from Ezra. He has wealth, so they couldn't bribe him. So they picked him. And then we find out what happens when Rabbi Gamliel is not around. Okay. Let's see.
On that very day, when Rabbi Gamliel was replaced, the gatekeeper was removed and all students were allowed to enter the house of study. Rabbi Gamliel had decreed and stated, any student whose inside is not as his outside shall not
tocho,
enter.
It's a nice expression, tocho, like the toch, the betoch, inside, kivaro, like bar. Bar is an Aramaic word meaning outside, like if you study Talmud, the Braita is the outside text. His toch was like his bar, his inners was like his outside, meaning some people, they feign to be scholars, pious people, but inside they're not. So he said, if you're not through and through, you can't come in. There are all kinds of theories as to what that might mean. Does it have to do with wealth? Does it have to do with your family lineage? But anyway, he was very selective as to who could study. And now they said anybody could come in. They opened the doors. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. But he makes this decree. Is he making this decree before he knows he's been ousted?
No. He used to say this. Now that he's been ousted, they open the gates and they let the floodgates. They let all the students in.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
More seats were added. Abba Yosef, son of
Dostai,
and the rabbis disagreed about the number of extra seats. One said 400 seats were added. The other said 700 seats.
In general, the word 400, Rabbi Chalap once suggested 400 as a rabbinic exaggeration number. And today we say a million. In those days, they said 400. That could explain why we weren't really in Egypt, slaves in Egypt for 400 years, and other stories. You can use the word 400 as a form of exaggeration. But anyway, a lot of people came in. Go ahead.
Rabbi Gamliel's mind weakened.
Chalash date, which means that he felt bad. Rabbi Gamliel felt bad that when I was there, I wouldn't allow these students in. Now I look, all these people came in. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe I should have let them in. So what happened?
Said, is it possible that I prevented Torah study from the people of Israel? He dreamed of white jars full of ashes, which his supporters understood as indicative that the students were unworthy, but it was not so. It was only to calm his mind that they showed him this dream.
So the Talmud has a whole reflection on his mind. In his mind, he thought, oh, I feel terrible. Maybe I should have let these students in. So then they find out that he had a dream. Nah, it's just a bunch of empty jugs of ashes. They're a bunch of nothing. And then the Talmud says that their commentary on the dream was that he's wrong. The students were worthy. He did do the wrong thing. He should have let the students in. But in the heavens, whoever shows you dreams, whether it's the dream angels or whether God himself, they just wanted to make Rabbi Gamliel feel good, so they gave him a nice dream. But the truth is, he kept students out. He was an iconoclast. He was an elitist of some sort, and he shouldn't have been.
But he kept students out by fear, because surely the gatekeepers they refer to or anybody, they're not judging each person. They say, really, you're sincere. You've got good common eye. So it must have been pure fear. They say, well, I'm scared to be there. I'll be humiliated. In other words,
very good. I mean, the idea that it had a gatekeeper, somewhat supported by the old story of Hillel who couldn't get into the Beit Midrash. Some historians have trouble with that. They can't imagine how that would be. But it could be there were some sort of gatekeeper, but that's a very good theory. You want to connect the two things we've learned so far. We learned that he's kind of tyrannical because he has his opinion and no one else is allowed to disagree. So in an environment like that, who would come in? So once once he's removed from being the head, many other people would come in. That's an excellent thought. I like that. Okay, go on.
On that very day, the tractate Eduyot was composed, and anywhere where it is stated on that very day refers to this day when Rabban Gamliel was replaced.
Yeah, so There's an unusual tractate called Ediot. Most tractates have a theme like Shabbat, Megillah, something like that. But Ediot is just a collection of all kinds of different topics that were testified at a particular occasion. And sometimes they say it was on that very day. What day? The day they replaced Rabban Gamliel. A lot of work got done on that day when they replaced Rabban Gamliel. Go ahead.
Any doubtful halachic issue in the house of study that was not discussed and decided. Moreover, Rabban Gamliel did not absent himself from the house of study for even a single hour, even though he was no longer president.
President, nasi, prince. Okay, so yes, so as it was taught. So so what do we see? Rabban Gamliel, he's basically fired, he's humiliated, he's impeached. And he doesn't stop coming to the academy even for one day.
Not only that, he accepts that he might have been wrong.
He certainly entertains the notion.
All these people are, so he has.
That's true.
He says if he accepted that maybe it should have happened.
That's very good. Right. Very often when someone is replaced by others, they take on new policies. They just become big critics of the policy. Oh, it's no good. And they just, totally critical. Here's someone who's willing to at least entertain the notion that maybe he was wrong. That's very good. And, this idea reflects, you know, his dedication to Torah study. He's very dedicated. What else does it show that he still came anyway? What does that show?
Puts the Torah, above his own ego.
That's good. Right, we describe this man who won't allow someone else to disagree. It sounds like he's very haughty. So the last thing he would do is subject himself to the humiliation of being there as the, you know, as someone who's no longer in power. I relate to it as a rabbi. Many rabbis have trouble, you know, after they're the rabbi of the shul, that they retire or what, you know, where do they sit? What seat should they sit in? How do they come to shul? Should they be in that community anymore? Can they still be? I mean, these are real issues that come up in every single community. It's not easy. And there he was. He's coming in to study. So in terms of cutting down the image of this great tyrant, we have, as Ben mentioned, the idea that, he's reconsidering his positions. We have the idea that he still comes to study. A very powerful notion. And that's all these great figures we have, that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and Hillel, they're all known for their great shkida, the notion that they just don't give up. I mean, they can't be scholars of that level. Even though he wasn't the same as Rabbi Yeshua, I don't think, but he can't be on that level unless you're day in, day out, all the time, always studying. Go ahead.
On that very day, Judah, a convert from Ammon in Transjordan, appeared before the house of study and asked them, "May I enter the community and marry an Israelite woman?"
Okay, now, as we'll say in a moment, it's clear, it says in the Torah, you may not marry an Ammonite. Go ahead.
Rabban Gamliel said, "You are forbidden to enter the community." Rabbi Yehoshua said, "You are permitted to enter the community."
That means, can you marry... someone. He was already already converted. That's not the question, but the question is, lavo bakahal means to marry a regular Jew, a Jew of a regular lineage. So they're having an actual discussion, as opposed to the Beit Midrash that Rabban Gamliel had, right? Where you can't have this discussion. Now, he's one of the players, one of the rabbis, and they're going to have a discussion. Go ahead.
Rabban Gamliel said to him, "Is it not written, an Ammonite or a Moabite is not to enter the assembly of God?" Rabbi Yehoshua said to him, "Are Ammonites and Moabites living in their place? Since Sanharib, the king of Assyria, has mixed up all the nations, as it is written, I have erased the borders of peoples. I have plundered their treasures and exiled their vast populations. The rule is, an exemplar is indicative of the majority. That is, most nations are now mixed up, so this convert, whose ancestry is unknown, may be accepted and not treated an Ammonite in the time of the Bible."
Go ahead. So they're saying that Sancheirev was this, he was a tyrant, and he just came in, and when he conquered a nation, he would mix them all up and move these people over here and all those people over there. So, therefore, no nation that you see today, the Egyptians are not Egyptians, the Moabites are not Moabites, and therefore, if one of these people wants to marry you, you don't have to follow the Torah rule that you can't marry a Moabite. He may call himself a Moabite, he may live in a place called Moab, but he ain't no Moabite because the people who live today in Moab could have just as well have been Bedouins or who knows what they could have been. So so he actually sort of changed the rule based on his logic, based on good reasoning and good sources. Now this may be exemplary of some sort of major difference between Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua. This is just speculation, but it's possible. It's possible that Rabbi Gamliel, like Rabbi Eliezer, according to the analysis of Vinnie Lau in his book, The Sages, Rabbi Eliezer, it's been suggested, he says in several places, I don't say anything unless I heard it from my Rebbe. So Rabbi Gamliel might be of sort of that school where we have certain rules, we have certain laws, and that's what they are. Rabbi Yeshua is a much more creative type. He usually uses a lot of midrash to come up with new ideas. We have several passages, I don't have them on the sheet here, where someone missed the house of study that day, so they say, hey, what's new in the Beit Midrash? From this particular era, they ask these questions. And they say, oh, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, this new whippersnapper rabbi, he taught the following. And why do they say what's new? Because this was an era where there was all this new stuff that was being said, new midrash, new ideas, and so this conversation could be very typical. Rabbi Yeshua says we have new ideas. Rabbi Gamliel says, I open the Bible, I see what it says. It's quite clear. I don't think it's that simple and stark a contrast, but there may be something along those lines that's going on. If you think of Rabbi Akiva, is sort of, he's the innovator squared. He's a student of Rabbi Yeshua who's constantly innovating. So things are developing very fast. Rabbi Gamliel is trying to hold things sort of the old way. Go ahead.
There's one interesting thought here. It seems typical to me that when any rabbi makes a decision, he wants to err if he errs to the more conservative side.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we have a tradition that's not from the Bible, but we don't eat chicken with
mm-hmm.
but for the to have a fence so that there's no mistake ever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's just the opposite. In other words, it's more humane to say, okay, they can be married. They can be married.
Yes.
But on the other hand, it's if you want to strictly follow the Torah, you just say, of course, yeah, he really is Moabite or Ammonite, or maybe he's not, but we won't take any chances. He can't do it. In other words,
right.
This is a very liberal interpretation based on the typical...
typical law. Right. So, yeah, the Rabbi Yeshua and his friends, would be more radical. They're ready to make chidushim, something new. And Rabbi Gamliel could represent something very old. Rabbi Yeshua, don't forget, is also a student of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. We said last week in Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai discussion that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he kind of opened things up. He said, well, what do you think? What do you think? If we can take that Mishnah in Pirkei Avos as exemplary of a certain approach of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the first rabbi after the destruction of the temple, no doubt he taught in Jerusalem also. This is the idea that let's hear different ideas. So the whole which is so typical of Mishnah and Talmudic study, which is debate, could be the Rabbi Gamliel was trying to stomp that whole thing out. Why would he do that? So there's a theory that the Beis Shammai, Beis Hillel, the students of Shammai and Hillel, who were arguing on so many different issues, it began to really divide the community. And we have some passages that indicate that they actually came to blows with each other. Could be that in the wake of that, in the wake of the destruction of the temple, he really felt that we must come together. And he wasn't interested in so much debate. And innovation also could lead away from you know, the way things were. He's trying to continue things after the destruction of the temple. You know, is this a time to innovate so we can manage with the new situation? Or is it a time to conserve so we can continue the way things were? So, this story brings it out very well. Now, so Rabban Gamliel says, but afterwards I'll restore the Ammonites from captivity so that one day they will come back. Rabbi Yeshua says, but you know, they haven't returned yet. Yes, one day the Ammonites will come back, but they haven't come home yet. So immediately the Ammonite was permitted to join the community. Rabban Gamliel lost his status as Nasi, as the leader. It made no difference. Rabbi Yeshua is superior. Those, presumably everyone agreed with Rabbi Yeshua, and that's the end of that. To even further explore this methodology Rabbi Gamliel, let's look at the Midrash, the Sifri. Sifri is the name of the official halachic midrash on Devarim. Excuse me. And interesting story. Go ahead.
There is a story of Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri and Rabbi Elazar ben Chisma, whom Rabban Gamliel put in the yeshiva to work, and the students didn't notice them out of their modesty.
So we have another story somewhere else that says that Rabbi Yoshua and Rabban Gamliel, the disputants, were on a boat once, and they had a discussion, and it came, and he said, well, what are you doing here? He says, well, I have to go collect money for these two students, Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri and Rabbi Elazar ben Chisma, because they know everything, they're brilliant students, but they don't have enough money to live. So Rabban Gamliel says, alright, fine, I'll give him a job in my yeshiva system. He had like a yeshiva system in different cities. So he puts them in charge, but they were so modest, it was like a counselor that no one notices that they're the counselor, right? Or mashgiach in the yeshiva is supposed to take care of the boys, and if everyone thinks they're just plain students. That's what happened. These guys were very modest. Go ahead.
At night, they sat with the students.
Which is not what they were supposed to do. They were supposed to sit with the faculty, not the students. Go ahead.
And this was the way of Rabban Gamliel. When he came in and would ask, then they knew that there was no one to challenge him. And when he would come in and not ask them to ask, then it was known that there was someone there to challenge him.
So in other words, right, he comes into yeshiva and he says, oh, anybody have any questions today? Then you know that there are no reporters. There are no detractors. But if he comes in and he doesn't ask that question, you know, any questions today? Then you know that in the crowd are saboteurs or someone who doesn't agree. So they sense that these rabbis must be there. These people are students of Rabbi Yeshua. You know, Rabbi Yeshua got them the job. I mean, Rabbi Gamliel gave them the job. Rabbi Yeshua got them the job. This is presumably before Rabbi Gamliel was deposed. And therefore he's afraid to say anything in their presence. Again, you know, I hate to talk about these people. Obviously, Rabban Gamliel could step on me in 2 seconds. I'm not claiming that Rabban Gamliel was not a great, great scholar of unbelievable proportions, but relative to Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Yeshua's students like Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri and Rabbi Elazar ben Chisma, probably Rabban Gamliel might have trouble holding his own. This notion that some rabbis could kind of step on other rabbis in those days is borne out in a later story in the next generation, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and Rabbi Natan. It's a funny story at the end of Horiot that the Rabbi Shimon Gamliel was known to not know the last tractate. Maybe he memorized everything except for the last tractate. So they figured out that he's got a weak spot. So the other students who were towered over him like crazy because they were not the Nasi, they did not have to deal with the politics and the institution, and they were a great scholar. From Rabbi Natan, he joined together with another rabbi, and they said, we're gonna take over this yeshiva, we'll catch him tomorrow, we'll ask him questions about this tractate, and he'll be humiliated, and we'll take over. So one of the students got wind that this was happening. So he came in front of he went to the yeshiva, sat right next to the chief rabbi, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, and he started reciting the Mishnah in Uksin really loud. So Rabbi Shimon Gamliel said, what's wrong with this guy? Why is he doing that? Oh, I know. There must be something. I better go study up. So that night he memorizes the tractate. They come in the next morning, they ask him questions about the tractate. He's got it on his fingertips, no problem. So we see that sometimes the students, who are the genius students, will sometimes try to challenge the head of the yeshiva, who is really a dignitary, a functionary, albeit a great scholar in our terms or in most people's terms, but not as great as these other people. So therefore, Gamliel, given that these students are there as counselors or whatever their job is they're getting paid for, he's not asking anything. So you get it? Go on. When Rabban Gamliel?
When Rabban Gamliel found them sitting among the students, he said to them, "You are doing a disservice. You are not being honored. Rather, you are being asked to accept a position of servitude."
So, based on Horio, I sort of merged the last two phrases. In Horio, the final thing he says to him, that he's giving them avdus, that he's actually, you think you're being modest, you don't want to take this position. You don't want to take this position because you're being modest, but you don't understand. I'm not asking you to take on some sort of honorific position. Any position of honor is really servitude. It's a beautiful expression. It's good. It's a good model for all of us to think of, that a rabbi, a president, a gabbai, anything we do in Jewish communal life, it's not an honor. It is a servitude. We become public servants, right? Obama was not elected to be the superstar. He's elected to be a public servant. That's what leadership is. So that's a beautiful statement. But what in this paragraph is most indicative of what might be a tyrannical style of Rabban Gamliel? If you're talking to Mike, what do we see here about his style?
He puts people down.
You mean in the end of the story that he's telling them? Well, you could say he's trying to get them a job, and these are young kids, and they don't know what they're doing. So he's kind of showing them how to work and all that. But he's the boss; he has to tell them what to do.
Continue.
No. I would say that what this story tells us is that there wasn't going to be any dialogue. As long as he was around, there's no dialogue. If anybody's there who has the ability to have dialogue with him, he's not going to have it. So there is no dialogue. So the very notion of what we conceive of as Talmudic discussion, he has no... if you take this radical reading of it, again, just from a couple of sources, it's hard to know exactly, but when he's in charge, there is none. So it's a very different view of what a Talmud and learning Torah would be. Again, if we take this view that Rabbi Lau professes, one of the other rabbis there, Rabbi Eliezer, takes the view that you just memorize what your teacher told you. That's it. It all comes from Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and that's it. You just say over the old stuff, and there's tons and tons of stuff that you learn from your teachers. And that's it. So that's the body of Mishnah. It could be that this is part of that view. Okay, so we have this figure who doesn't seem to allow for a lot of discussion. Now we're going backwards in time again to the period at which we mentioned before that Rabban Gamliel had embarrassed Rabbi Yoshua before. So let's read the Mishnah about how he embarrassed him in the story of Rosh Hashanah and Rosh Chodesh. Obviously, Rosh Hashanah and Rosh Chodesh are related. The affixing of Rosh Chodesh, in the case of Rosh Hashanah, changes the nature of when Rosh Hashanah is. It also affects the dating of Yom Kippur, the Sukkos, Simchas Torah, and everything else. So let's take a look at this. Of course, they used to affix the calendar by sight. That today we affix it we have a calendar. We know when I can know when my son's bar mitzvah is in 2 years from now. But in those days, not only you didn't know when the bar mitzvah was in 2 years, now you didn't even know when Rosh Chodesh was next month, because they would fix it each month based on the eyewitnesses who came and told you that last night they saw the moon was over here and it looked like that, and I saw a new moon, and they would check, make sure it was correct. If it was correct, they would accept it. Rabban Gamliel perhaps had studied some of the Greek studies and all that. He was an expert in astronomy, astrology, and he knew if the witnesses were lying or not. He had a board on the wall that explained how the stars were supposed to move around and where the moon was and all that. So let's see what happens when they come to his court in Yavne. Yavne, outside Tel Aviv there somewhere. Go ahead.
Mishnah. On one occasion, two witnesses came and said, "We saw it in the morning in the east and in the evening in the west." Rabbi Yohanan ben Nuri.
So that's the same fellow we met before.
Right.
That's the poor rabbi who's trying to work for a living. Go ahead.
Rabbi Yohanan ben Nuri thereupon said, "They are false witnesses."
So apparently, whatever the astronomy is of it, it can't be that way. It can't be over here in the morning and over there in the evening. Whatever they said doesn't make any sense. Okay, go ahead.
When, however, they came to
Yavne,
Yavne Rabban Gamliel.
When they came to Yavne, Rabban Gamliel accepted them.
Okay. On another occasion, two witnesses came and said, "We saw it at its proper time. But on the night, which should have been new moon, it was not seen. And Rabban Gamliel had already accepted their evidence." Rabbi Dosa ben Harkinus said, "They are false witnesses. How can men testify that a woman has borne a child when on the next day we see her belly still swollen?"
So they're claiming that the moon went away. The moon can't go away. They're false witnesses. Go ahead.
Said Rabbi Yeshua to him, "I see the force of your argument."
So he dared, in the presence of Rabban Gamliel, he dared to say, "I agree with the other guy." Okay? Not something he's supposed to do. Go ahead. Ben, can you talk into the mic?
Thereupon, Rabban Gamliel sent to him to say, "I enjoin upon you to appear before me with your staff and your money on the day which, according to your reckoning, should be the Day of Atonement."
Okay. So he told him he has to appear. And then Rabbi Yeshua was in a great quandary. Should he listen to the chief rabbi, the Nasi, and appear and basically agree with the rest of the community, agree with the official position of the head of the community that this was the day of Rosh Hashanah, therefore this is the day of Yom Kippur? Or should he say, "I have my own idea when Yom Kippur is," and refuse to listen to the chief rabbi? Probably there would be grave consequences if he doesn't listen to Rabban Gamliel. He could be prosecuted as a Zakein Mamre, as a some sort of a rebel rabbi. He could be banned or excommunicated, as Rabbi Eliezer eventually was under this system. Rabbi Eliezer was excommunicated later on, this other rabbi. So it's a major question. Rabbi Akiva plays a role. We'll talk about that next week. So Rabbi Yeshua is trying to figure out what to do. He goes to talk to different rabbis. Go ahead.
Rabbi Yeshua then went to Rabbi Dosa ben Harkinus, who said to him, "If we call in the question the decisions of the Beit Din of Rabban Gamliel,
People spell it Gamaliel. I don't know why, but go ahead.
"We must call in the question the decisions of every Beit Din, which has existed since the days of Moses up to the present time. For it says, 'Then went up Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel.'"
It's in the end of Exodus there. Go ahead.
"Why were not the names of the elders mentioned? To show that every group of three, which has acted as a Beit Din over Israel, is on a level with the Beit Din of Moses."
Notice it says the Moses and then the 70 elders. Whoever they are, whoever the elders of Israel are, they're just like Moses. Go ahead.
"Rabbi Yeshua thereupon took his staff and his money and went to Jabna to Rabban Gamliel on the day on which the Day of Atonement fell, according to his reckoning. Rabban Gamliel rose and kissed him on his head and said to him, 'Come in peace, my teacher and my disciple, my teacher in wisdom and my disciple, because you have accepted my decision.'"
So he says, "Wow, that's great." So what do we see about Rabban Gamliel in the end of this story? Does he say, "You idiot, you, how could you dare go against my rulings?" Right? He sees this great rabbi who he knows is towering over him in scholarship and everything else. Rabbi Yeshua is the greatest ever. And he's coming on his Yom Kippur, and he stands in front of Rabbi Gamliel. He traveled to Yom Kippur. He has money with him, and he's accepting the ruling of Rabbi Gamliel. Now, Rabbi Gamliel doesn't know that he accepted him not because Rabbi Yeshua agrees with him or changed his mind. Why did he accept it?
Because of the whole tradition of all the Beit Din.
Right. The Beit Din is the Beit Din. The head of the community is the head of the community. But the truth is, it could be completely wrong. It could be totally misguided. But whatever the court says, to some degree, that's what we do. But Rabbi Gamliel takes it as an acceptance of him. And he kisses him. He kissed him on his head, very loving a sentiment. He speaks to him softly, and he calls him my teacher in wisdom. He recognizes ultimately that there's a no contest here. Rabbi Yeshua is a greater scholar. To this day, we have a problem at Yeshiva University, any place, of are the greatest scholars. Should we put them in the position of the political head of the community? Yeshiva always had a president, and then it had certain scholars who were towering figures such as Rabbi Soloveitchik and others, who were actually the heads of the yeshiva. And you know, sometimes you need to separate between the two. But and briefly after Rabbi Gamliel, could be there was a period when Rabbi Yeshua does take over later on. But anyway, we do see a softer side of Rabbi Gamliel, more in the personal side. Here, you know, when it's just the two of them in a room in his house, we see a gentler Rabbi Gamliel. So far, what were some of the softer things we've seen about Rabbi Gamliel? What were some of the softer things so far? Right? We said that, yes?
It was more meaningful to me when he was deposed. Mm-hmm. And then showed humility and acceptance. Here, in this last story, it shows a softer side, mm-hmm. but it's a softer side after he was sort of built up or acknowledged as being right.
Right.
So it doesn't show to me the same character as the other story.
Right. Yeah, so that's true. He's in his full role as head of the community. That role's been preserved. Within that context, he can be very, very gentle. But you're absolutely right. It's only when he gets his way. But, nonetheless, I would assert that, you see that at a personal level, he is willing to say that Rabbi Yeshua is a greater scholar. And that's something. Moving along. Let's see. Want to flip the mic back? Want to take us through this page?
For 3 years, Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai disputed. These said, "The law follows us," and these said, "The law follows us." A heavenly voice emerged and said.
Some people said instead of a heavenly voice, it was a vote was taken. Go ahead.
"These and those are the living words of God, or the words of the living God. But the law follows Beit Hillel."
The Jerusalem Talmud in Brachot, at the end of the first chapter says, or at the end of Halacha 4 in chapter 1, it was in Yavne that the heavenly voice came forth. So actually, it could be that the idea that we follow Beit Hillel was established in Yavne. It could be under Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. It could be under Rabbi Gamliel. But the idea that we're kind of reining things in, we're narrowing down the halakha. It's not just craziness. Some people are following this, some people are following that. Rabbi Gamliel is trying to get things in order. Can you picture? They're trying to reestablish Judaism. Rabbi Yeshua is walking around saying, "Well, if you want to daven Maariv, you can. You don't have to." Right? How can you run around? We're trying to make a new rule, you know, a new rule over here. And you're making things so loose, it's not going to work. So Rabbi Gamliel insists, no, that there's something called Maariv. There either is Maariv or there isn't Maariv. If there's Maariv, everyone has to do it. You have to do it all the time. There's no question about it. Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, that means that thousands of things are different between different Jews. Can't have that. And then he takes it to a greater extreme. There can't be dispute about anything. I'm in charge. Now, you could argue that these were just isolated issues. Obviously, the rabbis, these same rabbis who were famous for arguing about thousands and thousands of things, the Mishnahs are full of debates between Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Akiva, and even Rabbi Gamliel himself. Surely there were debates, but maybe just on these hot-button issues, no debate was allowed. The more radical reading would say, no, until Rabbi Gamliel was deposed, you couldn't argue about anything. Anyway, but lest we left the impression that somehow he was only interested in authority, there are several sources that indicate that there's more to it than just a brutish authoritarianism. Go ahead, Ketubot, Daf 8b, Chet Amud Bet.
As it has been taught, at first the carrying out of the dead was harder for his relatives than his death.
So in other words, when somebody died, that was what they call a halvitzar. That was half a problem. But the real problem was, how are you going to pay for the burial? What are you going to do now? Go ahead.
So that they left him and ran away.
You can picture it, right? I've actually seen, not Jewish families, I've seen non-Jewish families, very poor, or whatever, and it drags on for like 3 weeks. Who's going to pay for the funeral? And, you know, obviously, not the best of families, but there can be such a phenomenon. Go ahead.
Until Rabban Gamliel came and adopted a simple style, and they carried him out in garments of linen. And then all the people followed his example and carried out the dead in garments of linen.
That's what we do to this day. We do sometimes use, cotton, but the point is it has to be a simple white garment. Go ahead.
Said Rav Papa, and now it is the general practice to carry out the dead even in rough cloth worth only a zuz.
Even the cheapest, nothing, sackcloth type of thing, perfectly good. No problem about it. So this whole idea of simple Jewish burial, which we take great pride in today, and almost every Jewish group, without exception, accepts this as a basic Jewish principle, comes from Gamliel. He gets the credit. So although he may have been a bit of an iconoclast, we have a story that maybe we'll get to next week in context of Rabbi Akiva. We skipped it before, that when Rabbi Gamliel had to apologize to Rabbi Yeshua, he goes into his house and he says, you must be some sort of a coal maker or something. Your walls are all black. He says, yeah, you don't know what it's like to be a yeshiva student. It's not easy. I had to do these crazy things for a living and I'm in great poverty. So on the one hand, he had no idea what the, you know, how the common man lived, but you know, even Romney could theoretically have a good policies for the poor. You know, just because you're rich doesn't mean you don't appreciate the poor. So here's a story that it shows, I don't know, a softer side on a personal note, but at least at a policy level, he has an interest in the poor, and he was willing to humble himself. You know, at his death. I mean, after all, if he's indeed some bombastic type who's in it for the ego, he wouldn't have allowed this, because that's very important to someone, is how they're buried and all the fanfare and all that. So I think it does show something about his actual personality. We have burial sites. There's a place in Yavne that they say could be Rabban Gamliel's burial. I don't think it has any great long historical background to it, but there are in the north, there's some of his grandchildren, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, and others. We may have their graves in the place, which slips my mind at the moment, but it'll come to me later. There's a place up north where we may have some actual burials of these actual people. Okay, so Brachot 16b gives a little more insight into his character, and also lighter and also upper class sort of characteristics come out in these two passages. Go ahead. Brachot 16b.
Rabban Gamliel bathed on the first night after the death of his wife.
It's always hard to know if it's Rabban Gamliel the first or the second. You see, before Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, there was another Rabban Gamliel, the elder, Hazaken. But let's assume a number of sources seem to indicate that this is the Rabban Gamliel we're talking about. So even though his wife just passed away, he bathed. Go ahead, his disciples.
His disciples said to him, "You have taught us, sir, that a mourner is forbidden to bathe." Right. He replied to them,
Shiva, you're not supposed to bathe if you don't have to. Go ahead.
He replied, "I am not like other men, being very delicate."
He's an istinus. He's very unusual. So it could just be a personal characteristic, irrespective of his wealth, or sort of a combination. Since he is from a wealthy family, he's just not used to not bathing. He has to. Of course, in those days, you know, bathing would be an expensive thing. You had to go to the bathhouse and pay for it and things like that. So only a wealthy person would constantly be bathing. Most people would just go, I don't know, once a week or once in a while. So he's someone who needed to do this. He also was known to be involved with politics. We have a lot of stories about him on various boats. Maybe he was going to Rome. We have him being called to Syria to speak to the governor. So, local Roman governor. So, then we have a debate where they review the Torah to see if there's anything objectionable. And they ask him to change a few things and he fiddles with it a little bit to make them happy. So he's a man who has to deal with the masses. He may have learned extra studies beyond Torah, such as some Greek studies, possibly. Also, he may have had a different haircut, different things in order to be part of the general society. So this is a reflection of that. But on a softer side, go ahead.
When Tabi, his slave, died, he accepted condolences for him.
As if he was a member of the family or something. Usually slaves, we wouldn't do that. Go ahead.
His disciples said to him, "You have taught us, sir, that condolences are not accepted for slaves."
For whatever reason, they don't usually want to treat the slaves like regular individuals and have people offer condolences for them. Go ahead.
He replied to them, "My slave Tabi was not like other slaves. He was a good man."
So there are many stories of sort of heartwarming stories of Rabbi Gamliel and his servant that he says, look at my Tabi. Tabi's so smart. He knows that a slave doesn't have to sit in the sukkah. That's why he's eating under the table, because he knows he doesn't have to eat in the sukkah anyway. And if you eat under the table, it's no good. So there are a number of stories where he's very proud of Tabi and how much Torah he knows. And so, you know, unlike some of our American heroes who were now saying, "Oh, they were terrible slave masters," and all that, this is the opposite. We're looking at Rabban Gamliel sort of in somewhat of a negative light, unfortunately. But here's a positive note in his relationship to the slave. He treats him very well.
There's an implication here that's not so favorable, which is he is not like other slaves. He's a good man, implying
true.
His slaves in general are not.
Yes. Right. I'm not claiming he's Abraham Lincoln, but right. He accepted the general system, I'm sure. But like most Jews, I would hope, he treated the slave well, and Jews in those days, 2,000 years ago, he treated the slave well, and he had an actual affection for this fellow as well. All right. Now, apparently Rabbi Eliezer was actually a brother-in-law to Rabbi Gamliel. So there's actually some family in the Beis Medrash, the great leaders of that time. Rabbi Eliezer was one of the great scholars on par with Rabbi Yeshua. And Rabbi Gamliel was the chief rabbi, but he was a brother-in-law to Rabbi Eliezer. So Rabbi Eliezer, he was banned. He refused to go along with another ruling that they had about a minor issue of impurity. And that was it. He was banned, and very sad, he lived his life in isolation. Terrible story. When he's dying, they come to him they can't get too close. You're not allowed to be within 8 feet of a banned person. So they stand 8 feet away and they say, he says, "What are you doing here now?" So he says, "Oh, we want to come learn Torah." He says, "You should have learned Torah your whole life." And, it's just very sad. Anyway, but again, the reflection of they were trying to keep the community together. Although we're talking about the idea that they then allowed debate, but there was supposed to be a bottom line to the debate. And he, even after having debated and they came to a vote in the bottom line, he didn't accept it. So he was banned. Go ahead. Why don't you take one more passage? Go ahead, Tana taught.
Rabbi Eliezer, his brother-in-law, was put in Cherem, a ban. A Tana taught, great was the calamity that befell that day.
We're now in Bava Metzia 59b. Go ahead.
For everything at which Rav Eliezer cast his eyes was burned up.
I don't understand this. It's hard to know, but whether the rabbis are speaking in metaphors or whether these people had great mystical powers, when he would look at anything, they would, you know, it would just burn up. I mean, he was so mad that, you know, he looked at somebody, you were in big trouble. He even said to Rabbi Akiva, you know, because you never came to study for me, you're gonna have a terrible death. Go ahead.
Eliel, too, was traveling in a ship when a huge wave arose to drown him. It appears to me, he reflected, that this is on account of none other but Rav Eliezer ben Hyrcanus.
There are many stories of Rav Gamliel on a boat. It must be that he was going either to Tyre, you know, going across the coast to northern Israel to visit his students up there, or that he was going to, you know, Cyprus or Greece, Rome, to be with the head honchos because of his position. But anyway, so the boat almost swallowed him up. So he realized that like Jonah realized that God was out to get him. He realized that his brother-in-law, who he had put in Cherem, was out to get him. So thereupon he arose
and exclaimed, Sovereign of the universe, thou knowest full well that I have not acted for my honor, nor for the honor of my paternal house, but for thine, so that strife may not multiply in Israel. At that, the raging sea subsided.
So it's a very, very moving thing. You can be cynical about it, but you can say that this reflects the real gut of Rabbi Gamliel. He says, you might think, God, that I did this for my honor, that I'm some sort of tyrant. No. You might think that I did this because I come from this fancy house of David and Hillel, and I want to show that we're the head honchos. No. He says, you know, God, that, and you know, when you talk to God, you got to be truthful. You know that I did this so there shouldn't be too much machlokes, too much debate, strife in Israel. That's why I had to ban this guy. He wanted to say that even after the debate was over, even after everything was counted and sealed and the votes were taken and the election was called, he wanted to come back and question it and to continue his position. Cannot have that. So although Rabbi Eliezer had every mystical power to overpower Rabbi Gamliel, who's Rabbi Gamliel to question the great Rabbi Eliezer? But bottom line, Rabbi Gamliel was in the right because he was trying to avoid too much debate. So we're talking about a society where there was tremendous debate, but they did try to get to a bottom line. And Rabbi Eliezer stood in the way of that. And so you see different levels of Rabbi Gamliel trying to hold things together. Maybe in his day they decide that Hillel, Beit Hillel, is correct. Definitely in his day there were times when he didn't allow any debate about certain issues. And then there were other times when, fine, there was debate, but then there was a bottom line, and those who didn't agree with that were in big trouble. But this is often brought as a proof that he's not a tyrant, he is someone who has a job to do, an unpleasant job of stamping out too much debate and dissension so that the Jewish people can be united. Temple is destroyed. We've got to stand together. We have to be united in what our practices are. And some I was reading a number of modern commentators think that in this era, there weren't as many sects. Now, generally, we say this is the period of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Essenes, and the Christians, and all kinds of other sects at that time. But at least maybe the Sadducees may have gone. They were gone. Internally, within the Jewish, within this part of the Jewish community, there was a certain unity of purpose. So he does also have to deal with the Christians. The name Gamliel does appear in Christian writings in the Christian Testament. Acts and Matthew and other kinds of books. And whether this is this Gamliel or different Gamliel or what, in one passage it sounds like he gave them a break. He gave the Christians a break on something. Our traditions around Gamliel made a blessing in the Shemone Esrei specifically against the Christians. So I don't know if we're talking about the same person. But anyway, it makes sense that if they were writing a book about the rabbis, they would say the rabbi's name was Gamliel, you know. Was he supposedly Paul's teacher? I think people think generally it's not true, but that's what some of their writings say. Some of their writings were written later, so it's hard to know. But anyway, it's interesting that this name does come up in their writings. Okay, now, so we just saw in Bava Metzia a notion of what's the motivation of Rav Gamliel. Hopefully it's not a personal motivation. It's one of trying to rein things in, keep the community together. Want to finish up for us? Okay. So in Brachot, we see in terms of a basic practice that we all know, we talked about Mariv. Let's look at one other practice, the idea of Shemona Esrei itself. What can be more basic to post-Temple Judaism? The idea of Shemona Esrei. No doubt it had its roots in the days of the Beis HaMikdash as well. You see certain prayers, they said, in the Beis HaMikdash. But after the temple is destroyed, it's so important to have the prayers in place of the sacrifices, corresponding to the sacrifices. And what does that look like? What does the Shemona Esrei look like? So go ahead. Talmud and Bracha 28b.
Our rabbis taught, Simeon HaPakuli arranged the 18 benedictions in order before Rabban Gamliel in Yavne.
This is how it worked. Apparently, the rabbis didn't write the poems, the prayers. People wrote them who were poets, who were spiritualists, who were singers or what, and they would write them in front of a great rabbi. If the rabbi approved, gave thumbs up, then it was fine. If it was thumbs down, then that would be the last time they made that prayer. Go ahead.
Said Rabban Gamliel to the sages.
Oh, so they say that it was the Shemona Esrei was already in existence. It was just sort of reorganized at that time. But go ahead.
Can anyone among you frame a benediction relating to the Minim?
Because he wanted another blessing. He wanted a blessing against the early Christians, which seems to fly in the face of the idea that somehow he was ever gave the Christians a break on some sort of story that they tell. Go ahead.
Samuel the Lesser arose and composed it.
Shmuel HaKatan, a modest person, Shmuel HaKatan, he, who wasn't really a great man, he composed the prayer. Then they forgot it, and then they put it back. Anyway, so one thing we see is that he did change this Shemona Esrei a little bit. One added blessing. It was originally 18. It could be it was originally 17. Now it's 19. Anyway, he added an additional blessing to destroy the heretics, by which some people say that he was referring to the early Christians. These are the days of the real physical fight between the Jews and Christians, and they fought it out, and here was a spiritual fight where they were praying against them. Okay, but the next Mishnah about the nature of Shemona Esrei, go ahead.
Rabban Gamliel says, every day a man should say the 18 benedictions. Rav Joshua says, an abbreviated 18.
Right, that in other words, maybe you could sort of just briefly say them, or maybe you can do the abridged version. Go ahead.
Rabbi Akiva says, if he knows it fluently, he says the original 18.
You should say it every day if you know. Go ahead.
And if not, an abbreviated 18.
Then you can say the abridged version. Go ahead.
Rabbi Eliezer says, one who makes his prayer fixed, his prayer is not supplication.
Right. So you could take Rabbi Eliezer as just an admonition. He says, yeah, of course, I agree you should say Shemona Esrei, but you know, you should change it up a little bit and add a different spirit to it and think about the new meanings. That's the less radical reading. The more radical reading is, you guys are crazy. You have 18 official benedictions. Nonsense. Let's just, you know, don't make it fixed. Make it whatever. So the same debate again. Rabbi Yeshua had said, make Mariv kind of loose. And here's Rabbi Ezra saying, make Shemona Esrei kind of loose. So Rabbi Gamliel says, you know, nothing doing it every day, Shemona Esrei. This sounds like Rabbi Gamliel. It must be done this way. Even in the Haggadah, we have something that sounds like Rav Gamliel. He says, anyone who doesn't say these three things, he doesn't get the mitzvah. And some people say that Rav Gamliel thereby helped, you know, formulate what is a Haggadah, what is the Haggadah, what is Pesach today. It's, you have to talk about the Pesach, the Matzah, and the Mar. You'll notice that Rav Gamliel, who says you have to explain what's Pesach, what's Matzah, what's Mar, it's different than the other rabbis who sit around and they tell the story, and they start with this part of the story and that part of the story. There could be the fundamental differences between Rav Gamliel and the others, maybe brought out. Could be that you can see them in the different aspects of the Haggadah. That you notice there's the story part of the Haggadah, and then there's the you got to say these three things part of the Haggadah. You eat these three things, and you explain the story as part of that. So it could be that he wasn't as much into midrash of a midrashic telling of the story as the other rabbis suggested. And you'll notice there's a seder there of the various rabbis getting together. You know, the five rabbis. Rabbi Gamliel wasn't in that seder. There's an alternate version of the story where Rabbi Gamliel was in a different seder. But at their seder they told the story, at his seder they told the laws. So Gamliel just thought you should talk about the laws. So he wasn't as big in midrash. I scanned the midrash on a number of occasions, in different forms, and Rabbi Gamliel is not deeply engaged in the halachic midrashim. He's not quoted that often. It seems that he has a different view. But anyway, but the idea of anyone doesn't say these things is no good. Every day you have to do 18 blessings. It's typical of Rabbi Gamliel's style. Very firm, strong, clear, and he's trying to set things up very clearly. But finally, there's a passage in Sanhedrin 104, which pretty much, I'm sure Ben will give me a hard time on this, but pretty much shows that he's a soft guy. And that is that they were talking about, you should surely weep at night. The Book of Lamentations talks about weeping. So the rabbis say, what does that remind us of? Oh, it reminds us of a story of Rabbi Gamliel. Because it happened, a child and a neighbor of Rabbi Gamliel died.
And she was weeping for him at night.
The mother was weeping.
Rabbi Gamliel, on hearing her, wept in sympathy with her until his eyelashes fell out. On the morrow, his disciples discerned this and removed her from his neighborhood.
So on the one hand, this story is unbelievable. We see that this Rabbi Gamliel, who, didn't allow Rabbi Eliezer to do his thing and didn't allow Rabbi Yeshua to do his thing, and he insisted Judaism has to be like this and not like that, and no one's allowed to debate or whatever. On the other hand, the woman crying, right? He cries his eyelashes out. He is an emotional wreck. On the other hand,
his disciples.
He's the chief rabbi. You can't disturb the sleep of the chief rabbi. So they got rid of her. So strange ending to the story. But in terms of what it tells us about Rabbi Gamliel, his students, I don't know. But in terms of what it tells about Rabbi Gamliel, we can't call him a tyrant. He's a softy. He really feels for the Jewish people. And maybe this explains what it's all about. Remember, he's a survivor. They wanted to get rid of him. He was the target. They were targeting him. He was like, all we need, all the Romans need is somebody who claims to be a descendant of David. Right? That's not the type of person you want to leave alive after the battle's over. Right? Because then he'll start another kingdom and look what he's starting here in Yavne. He's got a whole fiefdom over there. Somehow they got him out, and he may have been in hiding for a little bit because he doesn't show up. Like, first he's not there, and all of a sudden he's the chief rabbi. So he may have been hiding for a while. He survived, he saw the destruction, and he just hears a woman crying, and it brings back all these memories. He lost his parents. He's a very emotional person, and that emotion propels him to say, we've got to get things in order. We've got to get things shaped up. The community cannot be splintered into on 1,000 different issues of Beis Shammai, Beis Hillel. We can't have the millions of different things that Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Yeshua are arguing about, the two titans of his day. We've got to make decisions about these things. And this is the law follows this and not that. And the prayers have to be shaped up. The Haggadah has to be shaped up, etc. But it's all driven from this. It looks like a lot of bravado. He's a chief rabbi, but actually, underneath it all, he's a very mournful fellow, feels for the Jewish people. And, as he says, he just wants to make sure there's no strife in Israel. So, do we walk away with a sort of a funny feeling about him? Yes. There's strange stories. The people in his day, they raise their eyebrows, right? They say, a rabbi who doesn't have any enemies is not a rabbi. Okay, so he had a lot of enemies, so he was a good rabbi. But any rabbi who gets fired, he must not be a mensch. So some people felt he wasn't so menschlich in his day. Right? It's not for us to say that we feel that way, but certainly the stories are telling us that in his day, some people felt like he wasn't being very menschlich. But in the end, it's for an important cause to sort of hold things together. Yes?
Well, it seems there's an interesting, significant contribution here, which is, you said he may not have been quoted that much. Maybe his influence...
He's not quoted in Midrash, but he's quoted in the Mishnah constantly. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, the issue here, it seems to me, there's a tremendous contribution on the overarching structure of halacha, which is you have to eventually, whether you agree with it or not, you have to accept the ruling or the majority or the authority of the rabbi. He is maybe instrumental, at least from what we're reading here, in that concept.
It could be that after he died, things were a little looser. It wasn't as centrally located. We were up north in that place of Beit something or other where Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was. We were in Sipori. We were in Lod. We were in a lot of different cities. He himself, I explained in the bottom here in Hebrew, in Tiberias. He was in Kfar Otnai. Zako, it's an Usha. So there were other places that we weren't as centralized. And it doesn't seem that they were so big on deciding everything. As a matter of fact, the Talmud itself, of course, many years later, half the things are not decided. Half the discussions are not really closed. Some they close off and say, this is the law, period. Other discussions are left open. So it didn't necessarily change things forever, but it could be that at that early stage, if they hadn't, locked certain things in, then it would put us on a trajectory toward total, splintering later on. At least this way, there was some unity and it had some impact. One might argue that ultimately he lost the idea that there's one view and that's it, was lost. The idea of machloket, which perhaps his predecessor Yochanan ben Zakkai enjoyed more or relished in more, the idea that, oh, there's this rabbi, that rabbi, all the different students, and they have different ideas, could be that Hillel was part of that generation where there weren't that many debates, maybe four or five things Hillel and Shammai argued about. Yochanan ben Zakkai sets up more of a dialectic discussion and the dispute is rife, but they relished in it. And then Rabbi Gamliel tries to put the lid back on the can. He does to some degree, gets certain basic Jewish things shaped up. There's Maariv, there's a Haggadah, there's certain things are shaped up, but then afterwards things are loose again. He was trying to create a unified community after the temple was destroyed, but could be in the end, ultimately things didn't tend to run as tight as he did. But I agree with you, perhaps in that crucial era, had they let things be really loose, we'd have 10 different Judaisms.
He also represented, in that same line, he represented himself something interesting. I thought of as you were speaking. On one hand, he accepted, he was instrumental in Rabbi Eliezer's
ban.
And that was based on the authority of all the rabbis at the time. And on the other hand, he also was deposed by the authority of the rabbis, and he accepted that. So he showed both dimensions, both as a recipient and honored it, and as an implementer of it. And so that's unusual.
Yes, we're sitting here the day after an election, and that's one of the remarkable things about democracy in the United States. We fight tooth and nail, terrible recriminations are shared, and then the day after, you get up and you congratulate the other person, and you say it's a formality, but everybody does it. People would be shocked if he didn't. And, you put up a good fight, and I wish you well. Not every country has such a polite culture. But some will actually shoot each other. Others are just not so polite. Parliaments tend to be much more disrespectful. Anyway, yes, so in that sense, he was part of that type of tradition. he was deposed. He came to, he says, fine, so I'll be a senator. Who was the president of the United States who went back to the Senate? Was it Johnson or Jackson? I forget. There's one senator, but notice no one else did. Right? To go back into the Senate after you've been president, it's almost unheard of. But he did it, and it was a gentlemanly type of thing. And you'll notice there's a lot of gentlemanly type things here where the rabbi shows up, he kisses him on his head. Right? Even the rabbi who was banned, they all come to his bed to talk to him. Yeah. So that's what we'll talk about next week. Is Rabbi Akiva part of that glue that keeps things together? You know, it keeps the humor going. There's a little humor thrown in here today as well. Rabbi Yeshua, he kind of is the peacemaker between the different people. So we'll see some of those stories. But whoever's personality it was, they were able with their personality and the power of their learning and the power of their character to maintain a civil society. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Good. Thanks, Jason, for recording. Hopefully you didn't mind having the microphone too much.